decided to do a short Stanley curve. Similarly, because of the problem next, because of that same issue next term, what I did is scheduled 5 classes, but I made them 1.5 hours, because nobody knows if we go longer. And so that means in the spring it would be $45 for 5 classes, as opposed to $48 for 4 classes. So that would be, that's currently scheduled for the 26th of January through March 1st, Adventures in Awareness. But I just was talking with the administrator in charge of things, who actually called me up and asked me about this. There is a slight possibility that we would be able to do this as a non-credit class, in which case it would cost nothing. So we'd still schedule it for the 5 weeks, but for zero. So at this point, it's Adventures in Awareness, $45 for 5 weeks. I'll email you to let you know if it can be free. The reason that it's confusing.
Would this start in January?
What?
Would this start in January?
Did you just come in? The class is now 5 weeks in January, from January 26th to March 1st. Adventures in Awareness, $45 for 5 weeks.
No, I got the rest.
Yeah, but if it's possible that in January, January we'll be able to do the same thing for free.
All right,
second announcement. I haven't made any plans to assemble us between now and January, because I haven't had time to think about it. But it may be that I'll be inspired. And if so, I will email you and say, let's do a Zoom session on da-da-da-da-da-da, here's the link. Or let's meet somewhere, and here's where. So that's a possibility. We'll see what happens. Right, so any question or any question on anything before we talk about mindfulness a little bit and sit? All right, then. When Vipassana, the old name for mindfulness, was first evolved, and prior to that, when Hinduism was first being evolved, that was a long time ago, and in the East. And so the basic idea was, there's a lot you can't do anything about in the world. There's a lot of suffering involved in life. And if you want equanimity, you need to accept. Acceptance is the key. So the basic underlying precept of meditation is accept what is. But then, in the West, starting a couple thousand years ago, individualism started to rise, and then after that, science happened, and we began to understand that there's some things that you don't have to accept. You can change. We get some control that we didn't have. So the ethos in the West has been, make it better, progress, changing. And we are basically Western people. So that's deep in our, I don't know if it's in our DNA, but it's certainly in the way that we feel about life. When something is wrong, do something about it. Life is going to get better. Where we are right now is seeing that there's a coming together of the Eastern and Western approaches in each of us, especially, I think, in California right now. That is, there's a new understanding being evolved, which is a putting together of these two polarities. And that understanding is that acceptance is the basic platform. And then from that platform, one can make very skilled changes in something sometimes. So you don't need 100,000 lifetimes for everything to kind of figure itself out or come, you know, dissolve itself away, you can say, wait a minute, those thoughts that are in my head that are not helpful to me, I can do something about those thoughts. I can change those thoughts. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So the question is, what do you do, each of us? What is each of us, what do we do as a society? What is each of us do individually? And my own formulation for that is, you start with acceptance for two reasons. First, because it gets you out of being so lost in the forest that you can't, so lost in the trees you can't see the forest. The first thing you do is you let go, you take a step back, you open up, you accept what is. And then from that very clear perspective, when there's obvious changes that can be made, you make you skillfully make those changes. So when I sit, the first thing I do is I let go and I open up and accept what is. And then maybe toward the end of my sitting, when I'm very gathered and very calm and very clear sometimes, then I can go, wait a minute, I need to intend this or I need to change that. I think that the problem is that we're so used to changing that when we sit down, we think, I'm going to get better now. And so we make the effort is an effort to change right away. And that's a self-defeating effort. Or that's an effort that defeats what we're doing. So the idea when you sit down is doing not doing. Wu wei wu. I've heard it talked about. The idea that you let go of any attempt to change anything. You just open up for what is. And there'll be a persistent urge to do something about it, you know, or get to do it better, or to, you know, or to be more accepting, or whenever you feel all of it, you just go let go, let go, let go, let go, let go, let go. And then at some point it'll become clear that there is some step to be taken right then, or stuff to be taken later. Things will become clear to you. I should change this in my life, and then you go take that action. So I think it's a two-step process. Step one is acceptance. Step two is appropriate change. Second thing about mindfulness, I was going to have us do this here. I might actually do it in this spring. The mindful listening thing, where you actually listen to somebody else and you have to repeat back word for word what they said to check how well you hear. And everybody thinks they hear really well, but we fail pretty. It's difficult to do, to hear without letting your own thoughts get in the way. But we're not going to do that now. But what I would suggest is when you're talking to somebody else who's important to you, and especially when they're saying something that is meaningful to them, that you come out of your usual mode, which is to try to fix it, you know, or to sympathize or whatever, just come into being mindful at that moment, or at those moments, and just listen. Just completely open up so you're sharing the experience. It's their experience, and the two of you are having it, without any impulse to do anything about it. And that level of mindful listening is magic. That's the key to most of what good therapy is. But more than that, it's the key to really connecting. Because when it's so rare to be heard that way, without another person's thoughts getting between you and them. If there are no thoughts getting between you and them, there's just a direct connection. And that direct connection is rare and magical and healing. And all you need to do to make that connection is don't try to make that connection. Just find your breathing, soften and open, and listen. So mindful listening is it changes your relationship with everybody. And then the third thing that I just want to mention briefly is, I hope you all do this, but every once in a while, as you're walking around, you stop for a moment and go, where am I? Where are my feet? Where's my body? Is it alive? Am I here? Am I lost in thought? Am I here? That's a thought. Am I here? And so you touch reality throughout your day. Otherwise, you walk around for your entire life lost in an idea. And that's what the way most people experience life, as an abstraction, an idea. Every once in a while, you come out of that abstraction into right here, right now. And I think that's a good way to rebalance yourself from too much thought. So any question or any comment before we sit?
Did you hear the latest Sam Harris podcast?
So, say loud.
Did you hear the latest Sam Harris podcast? He was just saying that kind of psychotic, that we're just sort of in this dream world.
Okay, so if Sam Harris says we're kind of psychotic, we're kind of in this dream world most of the time. I disagree that we're psychotic. I think we're just deluded. You might want to come in through the other way, or just wherever way you're in. But don't leave the door propped open. Come in and then close it. Lori's behind you. You're out in the curtain. Good. All right. So don't open that. No. We want to keep the cool in here. No. We have a fan door. What? Yeah, keep it closed. Keep the door. We have fans going.
Keep the door closed.
Yes, door closed. It is closed.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, there we go. Thank you, God. Okay. All right. So let us sit for 10 minutes. So there is one thing, action, that you actually do when you sit. You let go of everything else. You soften and you open. You let go of everything else on the breathing. But the one action you do is you remember to pay attention. To what? To whatever you experience.
I'm experiencing somebody talking.
Thank you. to do several things today, or several places today. Some of which have to do with positive psychology. So let's start with something that I said I was going to, I would briefly talk about this. I said I was going to talk about it a couple of weeks ago and didn't get to it. That is the question of money and happiness. Remember? The question is, does money buy happiness? And the answer is pretty strongly traditionally been, no, money doesn't buy happiness. So let me tell you about some of the very newest research. Wait, hang on. Let's go. 50. This is 0. This is 10. This is happiness from 0 to 10. And this is annual income, $50,000 a year, $100,000 a year. And as of 2013, when the latest, the next to the latest official results came in from the Gallup World Poll, which is a poll of almost all the nations of the world and a representative sampling of people in all those nations, they get a lot of good information. And they ask people, they find out the income of people and they find out how happy they are, 0 to 10. And what they find is, pretty much around the world, the following curve. Looks like this. That is, when people don't have any money, and you give them some money, it raises their happiness quite a bit. So having no money is not the greatest idea we find worldwide. Eliminating extreme poverty will certainly be helpful. But what happens is, as we get more income, then, so this is, let's say, $10,000 and brings us from 0 to 2. And this is $10,000 up and it only brings us from 6 pool, 10 there. There. So here, if you make $10,000 more, going from 50 to 60, it only brings you up maybe half a point. So this brought you up two levels. The same amount of income rise now only brings you up much less than that. And it flattens out between $60,000 and $90,000 a year in 2013 dollars. So these days, they say 75 to 90. Is when it's absolutely flat. So it doesn't matter if you were making $100,000 a year, now you're making $1 million a year, doesn't change your experienced happiness at all. That's the official dogma. That's Daniel Kahneman, the Princeton professor who won a Nobel Prize for behavioral economics. This is his work, very well-known work. This is one kind of happiness measure. It's a measure of your actual experience from moment to moment. The way they get this measure, the best way they get this measure is they text people 10 times a day and say, 0 to 10, how happy are you? And then they get a bunch of other information, what you're doing, who you're with, you know, so they get a lot of correlations. And what they find is people's experienced happiness, how they're actually feeling, flattens out about $75,000 to $90,000 a year, U.S. dollars. But doesn't make you don't get happier if you make more money. However, when they ask people, how happy are you from 0 to 10, like think about your whole life and tell me how happy you are,
then people give you a different answer. Then it looks like this. Well, it's up much higher. Maybe approximately $150,000 a year is when it flattens out. So people's story that they tell themselves is different than their actual happiness. Okay. By some accounts, it never flattens out. There's a person that's making $500,000 a year, and they make $1 million a year. If you ask them, they say, "Oh, I'm so much happier than when I made $500,000 a year. I couldn't even afford a Ferrari then." So the story keeps getting better, but when you actually monitor them, it doesn't change. Their happiness at a much lower point flattens out. So look at this way. If you want to delude yourself, make a lot more money, you'll think you're happier, but you actually won't be any happier. So this is the official dogma, which is not having money makes you miserable, but having money past the point at which you're reasonably comfortable does not make you happy. From the American Psychological Association Monitor, which is a magazine that goes out to all members of the American Psychological Association. And this is from last month's APA Monitor, so it's very new. $500,000 is the new $75,000. According, I actually read this research, so I can tell you a little
bit. Is that the title?
According to a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is a good, credible listing, money does appear to buy happiness, at least for most people, up to annual earnings of $500,000. The reason that it doesn't increase happiness beyond that is because they couldn't get anybody else in the sample. They didn't get anybody in the sample that had more money than that. So they only did it up to $500,000. We don't know. Okay. This contradicts a similar study about a decade ago that showed happiness improved with earnings up to about $75,000. Researchers asked 33,391 working adults in the United States with a median household income of $85,000 to report happiness levels at random times throughout the day. So they're getting an actual experience of happiness. They found that for most people, happiness does improve linearly with earnings up to $500,000 a year, although few participants earned that much. However, for about 15% of people, additional income failed to improve their income. For about 15 or 20% of people, additional income failed to improve their sense of well-being once they crossed the $100,000 threshold. So for about 20% of people, it flattens out at about $100,000. That 20% is depressed, which is about what the statistic is these days. So for about a fifth of us, happiness, we can only get to a certain level of happiness because our depression keeps us from getting any higher. So for about 20% of people, it doesn't matter. I mean, they don't make more money over $100,000. Meanwhile, the happiest 30% of participants, the people that started out the happiest, so the people that start out depressed, flatten out. Doesn't matter how much. The people that start out the happiest 30%, experience feelings of well-being that sharply accelerated once their income exceeded $100,000. So now what we have is, we have this. This is the 20%, lowest 20%, who are depressed enough so that money doesn't make any difference once they're reasonably comfortable. Then for 50% of people, it just keeps going up like this to $500,000. And for about 30% of people, it goes like this. The more, I had 300, now I got 400, now I'm way happier. At 400, now I got 500, I'm over the moon. So this totally contradicts the earlier research and says that money does buy happiness. How about that? So Dan Gilbert was right, the Harvard guy who said, if you don't think that money is important, give me yours. However, what they didn't say here, so now you're thinking, oh, damn, I should have gone, you know, I made the wrong choices. I should have made more money. The moral to the punchline here is most important, and it's not reported here, which is effect size. How big an effect this is. When we compare people making $25,000 a year and people making $250,000 a year, we find that their average happiness level is about 5% different. So it is a very small effect. Okay, to understand? It means that if a person making $25,000 a year on average is about a 6, a person making $250,000 a year on average is about a 6.5. Not very much difference. A weekend versus during the week makes more difference than that. A headache makes 3 times more difference than that. However, marriage makes only half the difference. These are the statistics I got. All right. Any questions on this before we move from this absurdity? So what I just told, to summarize, what I just told you is happiness does, money does influence happiness, just not very much. except if you don't have much, in which case, much. Bernie.
Well, what I found is when I made more money, and I made more than kids, then I felt really good.
Okay, so
what do you do with your money?
What you do with your money is another factor that makes a huge difference. There's a lot of data that shows that people that spend the money on themselves versus people that spend it on other people. People that spend it on themselves doesn't really do much. People that spend it on other people have long-lasting boosts in happiness. So when you give it away, it turns out that 2 people are happier. The person you gave it to, and you. And there's a lot of research that shows that. Gordon.
I just heard something on NPR this morning about seniors who are saying that a lot of them are really unhappy because of inflation. That the prices went up so much. And they can't replace the income because they don't have a job.
So that is a big problem. And the problem is that when you don't have enough money, money really does have a big impact. And when you think you have enough money and then suddenly the world changes and you don't have enough money, you don't have anything to do about it, that's depressing. Rich.
Why are the 20% depressed? Can they just be complacent or happy that they're at that level?
Maybe, but what I read is that in the research they said these are people that are probably due to their depression. And that's terribly, you know, the statistic on how people's mental health is, as you know, is pretty bad and getting worse. So we're doing something wrong with the way we're living. Even though it's called the Easterlin paradox, which is, for many years they've been tracking this, quality of life keeps going up. People get richer, they get more stuff, there's less poverty, et cetera, et cetera, except very recently. But even though the real income keeps rising, happiness is either entirely flat or slightly going down. And that's called the Easterlin paradox. You see it all over the place. Barbara.
Do you think the same is true in the developing world as opposed to the industrial world? If they use cell phones, it's all in industrial.
Well, everybody in the world has. And yes, I think so, because this is based on the Gallup World Poll, which goes everywhere. So, yeah. Then when you just adjust the income levels. One more thing, I mean, this is a whole huge discussion. I teach a whole semester on this, but one more thing to think about is income inequality. In countries where everybody's fairly much at the same level, if poor, people are usually pretty okay. But in countries where there's a great income disparity, even in fairly rich countries, people are not so happy. The greater the income disparity, the more social unrest, like in this country, and unhappiness you see. So, did I see a hand? Phil, did you?
I was about to say income inequality.
Yeah, and there's many Wilkinsons. If you really are interested in this, Google Wilkinson TED Talk. He's the guy that has the most information about this, as far as I know. All right, I want to move to something else. I'll just let you know that the money doesn't buy much happiness. All right, so now what we're going to do is our annual checkup. I'm not sure this is exactly annual. I don't remember the last time we did this. But this is not a physical checkup. This is a psychological checkup. This is a well-being checkup. And I'm going to use the chakragram to do it in a modified way. So how many people have done a chakragram with me? I think most of us have done it, right? Okay, I'm going to do it again because it's, I think, a really good vehicle. But I streamlined it so it's easier to do. And at the same time, I added a component which will give us much more information. Okay? So what you will need is your writing implement and a hard surface and one of these. And I think what I'm going to do, because I want to wake you up, is I'm not going to pass them out. I'm going to put them on the table and you're going to go get one. How's that? So, get one of these. And that way you will, say, simulate, or you don't want to, somebody else to get for you.
I got an email from him.
I sent you the article and you can look for yourself.
You're talking about the APA article.
The one that I just mentioned.
The APA.
It's in the National Academy of Proceedings, the Academy of Science. Not this article. That was the tiny thing. The actual article. Some of the math I can't even understand. It's a big mess. All right, so everybody got one of these? So you have to kind of listen to how to do this time. Usually you do this in a fairly meditative way. I want to do that, but you're also going to need to use your intellect a little more. So, I got to show you. Just to remind you. By the way, swd.org/Spencer is where you go for past classes and a whole lot of other good stuff, thanks to Robert. And drspencersherman.com has some things that help with meditation, some guided meditations, some with music and some without, and also has some videos that might be helpful for meditation also. Right, so what did I do with that? So you see these seven circles? Well, They represent the chakras roughly. We'll talk about them later. But for each one, here's what you do. So here's a representative circle. So I'm going to ask you just one question. And you're going to, so we're going to be sitting kind of in a meditative way, and I'm going to ask you this question. And you're going to decide how much the answer is yes, how open this is, or how much the answer is no, how closed this is. And you're going to leave the circle uncolored to the extent that it's open. And you're going to color it in to the extent that it's closed, like this. Okay? So this is about 70% open, 30% closed. And then I'm going to ask you to write down the next to the circle, write down the question, and write the question next to it. And then on the right side, you're going to write what came to your mind about what's closed or what's no. So let's say this was about, this was about my feeling, how satisfied are you with you with your teaching at Santa Barbara City College? And I would go like this, and I would go like this, about like that. How satisfied am I with my teaching at Santa Barbara City College? And what came to my mind is ridiculous time demands, lack of engagement in of students, being forced to do more and more classes online. You know, it would be a bunch of stuff that would cause me to not feel entirely good about this. And I would just jot those things down. Just a word or two. Because it's not going to be a long thing we're going to be writing. But the idea is to, for each of these questions and each of these areas, what comes to your mind that is the things that are preventing full openness? Got it? Okay. And if you're dissatisfied with what you make the first time, I have many extra copies of that circle. You can go home and do it again. All right, so here goes. How do we know which?
How do we know which chakra circle?
Oh, we're going to start from the bottom and go up. Okay. That's typically the traditional way it's done. Thank you for asking, Mary. Just start from the bottom, you don't start from the top. Okay, so let's just sit for a moment to get... Yeah, the idea is to get gathered and quiet so that you really are focused. So the bottom circle, how healthy and safe do I feel? How healthy and safe do I feel? Write that to the left, and then color it in. How healthy and safe do I feel?
come back to meditating once you've jotted stuff down. Second one from the bottom. How much pleasure do I take? How much pleasure do I take? In general, how much pleasure do I have? How much pleasure do I take? Back to sitting, meditating once you've jotted stuff down. Third circle up. How strong is my sense of self? How strong is my sense of self? fourth circle up, the middle circle, how fully do I feel? And how much do I feel all my feelings? How fully do I feel? Fifth circle up. How freely do I express myself? How freely do I express myself? Thank you. next circle from the top, 6-1 up. How open and curious is my mind? How open and curious is my mind? Circle. How completely do I feel connected to something beyond myself? How completely do I feel connected to something beyond myself? How completely do I feel connected to something beyond myself? got in front of you is an x-ray of your psychological function. And it's a diagnostic x-ray in the sense that what you wrote down to the right are the issues, the things that could use some sort of improvement. Might not be, all of them might not be improvable, but some of them certainly are. So it's the first a diagnosis, and then it's a prescription. Look at it overall and see how much is colored in versus how much is open. To the extent that it is open, you feel alive. This is another way to look at this is this is a view of your aliveness. So to the extent that it's open, there is life energy flowing through you in all the ways that life energy can flow through a person. To the extent that it's closed, life energy isn't flowing through you completely. And nobody has this entirely open, except for the businessman that I did this week once at El Encanto Hotel, and nobody colored in anything. Because, oh yeah, this was I got to pay a lot of money to do it. This was a big deal, but nobody wanted to admit that they were less than perfect, especially in the company of other CEOs of large corporations. Unbelievable. The only people that colored it in were some of the relationship people that came along with these CEOs who actually did this. But other than that, everybody has colored in to some extent because not all of us are a work in progress. Okay? But this gives you an idea of how much life energy is flowing through you versus how much could flow through you. You also want to look at if there is more colored in at the bottom than the top, or top at the bottom. The frequent pattern in this culture is that there's more colored in at the bottom than the top, which is interesting because of what we'll say, okay? So this is, I'll give you a short version of this. Of the many ways to look at our functioning, the way that is the most inclusive, it seems to me, is not a Western personality theory. They seem to address one or two of these areas. The one that addresses all the areas seems to come from the Hindu tradition. This is my adaptation of the Hindu chakra system. Those of you who do yoga, the idea that there are seven energy centers that are centers of life energy in your ethereal body and also corresponding to your physical body. There's a big point about that. And this is a more comprehensive system than any of our Western systems. So what this says is when we look at a person, we look at how alive they are in various ways. And this is a simple way to look at the various kinds of aliveness we can have. So presumably, from the Hindu point of view, by the way, the chakra system, I did a little research. You would think it was 5,500 years old like Hinduism, but it's not. The idea of life energy and opening up blockages is very, very old. But the codification of the chakra system that most of us are familiar with is a 20th century phenomenon, essentially a Western phenomenon. However, how it builds on an earlier understanding, which is that we have chronic closures because of what has happened to us in our life that are restricting our aliveness in various ways. And the idea of yoga is to open those closures, and also the idea of meditation, to open those constrictions, those strictures. It's not a bad thing to close, but if you chronically close, then you prevent that function from happening. So we'll go up these now. In the Hindu system, this is your energy body, which corresponds to areas of your physical body. I think it is an interesting set of correspondences, because frequently what they're talking about in terms of life function really does have to do with certain of these areas. So we'll talk about that. I'm not convinced entirely that these areas are exactly. I'll leave it. Right. So the lab area. How healthy and safe do I feel? That I wrote one word that I put next to. I would suggest putting next to the very left-hand side of the diagram. If you have any next to the question, I left a little space. So somewhere put the one word that defines the energy center. I don't call them chakras because I've adapted them, and people that are purists, chakra purists, go. So these are energy centers, okay? Or ways that you can be alive. So the bottom one is support. S-U-P-P-O-R-T. S-U-P-P-O-R-T. Support. So, what your physical body, what supports you? Your lower body, right? That's what you're built on. Your lower body supports you. And supposedly the lower body is the what this first area has to do with. It has to do with how supported you feel in life, how secure you are in your life. And there's two aspects of it that I included in the question, which is your physical health. Because if you're not physically healthy, you don't. There's a question about how much life energy you have. Some of that you can do something about, some of that you can't. And then there's a question of how safe you feel. And that's a psychological it's a psychological and social question. Because how safe you feel has a lot to do with how you were raised. Those of you who know attachment theory, basic trust versus mistrust, it comes from extremely early childhood. Pre and perinatal psychology talk about the gestation and birth process, making some newborns already anxious and other newborns already secure. So there's a lot of evidence piling up that some people are just more secure in life than others. They come into life more okay with it and able to deal with it than other people that have a basic anxiety. So that's the psychological level. The social level is, even if you're a pretty secure person, it's not such a great world out there right now. And so that impacts your feeling of stability, of support, of being okay. Now that area, that lower area, is really important because it's the governing, it's the area that brings in life energy. Remember I told you about the flowering, the fruit tree? What's the first thing that the seed does? It puts down a root. That's how it gets its energy. So if you don't have, it's called a root chakra, actually. So if you don't get enough, if you haven't got enough basic life energy, then it attenuates what you can do with all these other aspects to yourself. So it's a difficult, if that is somewhat closed off, it weakens or it lessens the amount of energy you have for anything else. By the way, supposedly these areas, the energy comes in from chi, the life energy that's everywhere, and it comes into you through, you kind of come, it comes in through the bottom, and then it moves up the spine and out the top of the head like a fountain. So a fully alive person would have life energy flowing in, flowing up, and flowing out, not only this way, but also in each out this way in each chakra. There would be a flow of energy out here, as we're going to go up. So conceived of from an energetic point of view, this is about how much energy comes into you, comes up through you, and comes out from you. And sometimes people who have difficulty in this area actually have physical difficulty having to do with the lower body. They don't feel supported, and it represents physically. Bernie?
Yeah, don't you think we can do the same test?
Say again?
No. Do the same test in your 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 would be a little different then?
I have done this now for about 15 years, and I have them all. And there is a gradual evolution. But by no means is it entirely different. And I think that some of these are more amenable to change than others. I think the bottom one is the least amenable to change. It's the hardest one to change.
people that have, if you have a plant that you, it's not doing well, and you fertilize it and you water it and it still isn't doing well, the only thing you do is transplant it. You can actually give it another life. You can rebirth it. Some people have to go to that level to open up that kind of closure. But there are therapies, both traditional and alternative, for all these things. So this is a big lecture in terms of what I'm trying to do. Okay. All right, so that's the first area. So after the lower body, and again, it has to do with how secure you are, how much support you feel. Second area, if we were a fruit tree, first the seed puts down a root, then it puts up a shoot. You got to go toward that which would give you life. So pleasure in nature, the reason that creatures have pleasure is because pleasure signifies that which is life promoting. So it induces you to go get more of that. And displeasure signifies that which is life diminishing, and it induces you to go away from that. Approach and avoid. It's the basic way that plants and animals of any level of complexity survive. They go toward the good stuff, and they go away from the bad stuff. So if you're not taking, so pleasure is really primary. This is supposedly at the level of the genitals. It's misunderstood as being sexual only. This is more generally, do you feel motivated to go toward things, to open to things, to experience things? Or do you not have any, similarly, are you motivated to go away from things which are not okay? Or are you kind of frozen there? Like a lot of people have lower back problems,